Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to another segment of Afternoon Satsang, being broadcast live from God's own radio channel, Radio Sai Global Harmony, from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. I am Arvind from Team Radio Sai, and along with me is Prem from Team Radio Sai, as always, joining us in this satsang. First and foremost, I would like to offer my most humble pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan, who is very much a part of this satsang. And then, Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all listeners from all across the globe. And I join you in offering my humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet.
Prem, it has been 2 long weeks since we haven't had this satsang. Last week, unfortunately, because of power outages and other technical problems, there was this stoppage.
Something we couldn't do anything about.
And how much, I remember how much we spoke that day about missing it and how empty it felt. Somehow, Prem, this satsang has become so much a part of my week that something seems to be missing, something seems empty, like a big void, if that is not, if that doesn't come through, it doesn't happen.
And I remember even as the slot was on, you know, during that 12:30 to 2 of last week, I did get a few calls as to what happened. You know, those who had not seen our notification about the power outage when called up, it was happy to be missed in a sense.
Correct.
It made us feel that yes, we are doing our bit to take Swami to people who want him.
And you know, Prem, one more interesting thing I remember during the convocation drama practices, every day, at that time, Narasimhamurthy sir, he was taking charge of the dramas.
Right.
And I remember because we were a team that used to work closely along with him in scripting the drama, deciding the cast and all that.
Okay.
So, he used to emphasize on one thing. He used to always say that irrespective of what happens, every day at 6 o'clock we should have our practice. So, he was very strict about this timing. While everything else he was ready to change and, you know, a little flexible. But when it came to timing of the practice, it had to be at 6 o'clock in the evening.
Okay.
So, I used to wonder what is so, you know, sacrosanct about the 6 o'clock or what is so sacred about it. And as the days passed, I realized one thing, that every evening, you know, this actually happened after the convocation drama was complete on the 22nd of November.
Okay.
The next day at 6 o'clock, you know, the feelings that are arising within me are so different. You know, it's something different. It's not me. And then I realized that inadvertently, without my knowledge, unconsciously, I'm getting into my role, which I'm performing in the drama, you know. Those feelings, those thoughts, those are coming into me. And that is because, irrespective of what is happening, every day at 6 o'clock, we used to have the convocation drama practice. And then Narasimhamurthy sir also told us that is exactly the idea. When you do it like that every day, on the final day when you have to perform at 6 o'clock, you will not actually have to act. You are automatically into that role because that is what you have been doing. And he said that is the basis for which regular sadhana and consistent sadhana is always emphasized upon. It's not enough that suddenly one day you take off and 24 hours you are engaging yourself in sadhana and after that you take a holiday. Persistence and perseverance is important. And how many, Prem? I have no idea. About 25 sessions have you finished,
yeah,
satsang?
I think much more than that. 31 I was counting yesterday.
Wow. So, that has become so much a part of the weekly schedule now that come Thursday and come 12:30, if there's no satsang, you feel something is missing, something huge is missing. And I'm very grateful to Swami and Swami's instrument, that is Radio Sai Global Harmony, for giving this beautiful chance where automatically every afternoon on a Thursday, you feel that we have to speak about Swami, otherwise there's no fulfillment, there's no completion.
And you know, talking of being instruments in Swami's hands, reminded of what Swami told one devotee once. When the devotee prayed that, Swami, I should be your instrument, Swami said, you don't have to ask me, you already are one. And that is what, you know, comes to our mind, especially, I think we should mention about that feedback we got from Japan a couple of weeks back. And it was so heartening to read that. Dear listeners, one devotee from Japan wrote to us that she is actually going through her pregnancy, and so she's bound to her room. So the only seva she does is, she was saying that she shares some of the talks she hears on Radio Sai. She mails it to her friends and asks them to listen. And one of the talks which she is sharing with others is also our afternoon satsang which we've been having. And one devotee wrote back to her saying that one particular afternoon satsang, I think the one on how can God be compassionate if there is so much suffering
in the world. Yes.
And she said it was so perfectly timed for me because I'm going through very tough times. And it really gave me so much of solace when I heard it. And dear listeners, when we read that feedback, you know, what we couldn't believe or what we couldn't help ourselves from thinking is that that was not the topic for that afternoon satsang. In fact, we thought that we will start with that and lead to the topic which we had desired for that day. But it so happened that that entire satsang...
Yes, I remember. In fact, after we completed the satsang, we were talking to each other saying, oh, what a digression this was. But anyway, it grew up and flowered into a complete satsang by itself. So it's not...
We kind of considered it as Swami's will, and we said, okay, this is the topic Swami wanted us to speak on, and so be it. But you know, to think that it had to reach one devotee so far away in Japan who really needed that satsang that day. I mean, what are we discuss two or three days ahead what to speak about, and we draw our points. But I think Swami sends through
really,
us what he wants to say.
Really, Prem, it is such a lovely feeling, and it humbles us. It humbles us and makes us eternally grateful to Swami. It also reminds me of a small episode, you know, that took place near the interview room.
Okay, sure.
Once Swami came out, and when he came out, those were the times when for 15 minutes before the bhajans, you know, there would be a flute playing or a sitar playing a musical piece for 15 minutes. And when Swami came, he was gently swaying to the lovely flute music. And he asked one of the boys sitting there, where is the music coming from? He said, Swami, and he pointed to the speaker up there.
Right.
Then Swami said, but where is the music actually being made? Then the boy realized what Swami was asking. So he pointed to the bhajan hall and he said, Swami, inside. Then Swami said, speaker may be outside, but it's always created inside.
The source is inside. The
source is inside. And that is what it is, dear listeners. Many times, many of us would have experienced this, where we speak, think or do things. Maybe, you know, we call it gut feeling, we call it instinct, we call it intuition. But all these are occasions when God chooses us to be instruments. And we have to be grateful for this opportunity and humbly bow down and hope that the ego doesn't come in. Because as Lord Krishna said, the flute is used as long as it's hollow. Once anything fills, it's an obstruction and music does not come out of it. Well, with that elaborate sort of introduction, a lot has been happening in Prashanthi Nilayam for the last 2 weeks. And one of the most significant, most auspicious, most beautiful festivals, Shivratri, that was what happened this weekend. And Shivratri has been special for many, many, many reasons. Directly the physical reasons. Yes, Swami used to perform the Lingodbhavam. Swami used to do the Vibhuti Abhishekam to the Shirdi Sai statue. And if our listeners had logged in to the RadioSai.org website, they would have watched these beautiful clips which were interspersed between the programs.
Right.
So, all those apart, Prem, I find that Shivratri festival is very, very special because it has got something to do directly with the topic that we plan to discuss today.
Yeah, and so you said that what we plan to discuss, let's see if that's the topic we come to today. Talking about Shivratri, yeah, you were talking about the significance of Shivratri and how it has a bearing on what we want to talk today. It's got to do with the waning of the moon, which Swami used to talk about, right?
Correct.
Because in Hindu mythology, Shivratri actually comes every month. There is a Masa Shivratri, they call it. It comes every month. That is in the 14th day of the waning phase of the moon.
One day before Amavasya or the new moon
Chaturdashi,
day.
Chaturdashi, when the moon is the leanest in its appearance in the sky. And one Shivratri of the year is supposed to be the Mahashivratri, which is celebrated even in Prashanthi Nilayam. So what Swami says is that, you know, and it is also established that the moon has a bearing on the mind.
Yeah, Prem. The Vedic statement that says that is Chandrama Manaso Jata. So Swami has often told us that the moon and mind are completely related.
Right.
In fact, you know, the other day when I was reading through, there's a book on sun signs by Linda Goodman.
Right.
And the sun sign Cancer is supposed to be ruled by the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And there it is written that, you know, on a full moon day, you will see Cancerians behaving a little crankily. Because the moon is the presiding deity and the moon, I mean, in many, many ways, across cultures, you know, the moon has been related to the mind.
Now, actually, even in psychiatry, those who are mentally ill, they can see behavioral pattern changes in
according to the phases,
the phases
of the moon.
So it's an established fact.
So Swami says that the mind is least controlled when as the moon is waning.
Right.
And on a new moon day is the best day to be, you know, freed of all the different problems and obstacles and thoughts and all the things that arise from the mind. A very fertile day to concentrate on spiritual pursuit.
Right.
And therefore, Swami says on Shivaratri day, when the moon is at its weakest, you know, it's like striking the iron when it's hot, making hay when the sun shines. So, getting rid of the mind when it's at its weakest.
Right.
Spend that day in Namasmarana, think of the Lord, and attain the highest. Because that day is very, very special. It's also dedicated to Lord Shiva. Now, this mind going into nothingness is something very special with regard to today's topic. But I think, Prem, before we introduce what is our topic today, since we have got our notes here, we are able to compare and see how it is flowing with the last three satsangs. Maybe you should briefly summarize what we have done for the last few weeks, what we have discussed and what has arisen, so that we can lead on to today's topic.
Exactly. I mean, it's been a fascinating journey, to say the least.
Mm.
I think we started off on Feb 14th, like how we mentioned it last week also. I mean, a couple of weeks back also. It started with the discussion on love. And that has led...
That was something like a Valentine's Day special.
Right. But you know, even we have come to see that love is such a deep topic. And we so flimsily use that word. And even when we use it in our conversation with Swami. But it has so many deep emotions involved within that small word, and I think that's what we've been exploring over the past few weeks. So we started off by talking about what is love and what are the various aspects and features of love. And then the satsang following that, we spoke of that episode which we mentioned before, you know, the how can God be compassionate
when there's so much suffering
in the world. And there where we said, how can we say God has love when we see suffering and pain? And that was the topic we discussed. Then we went on to say that when we say we love Swami, do we really love Swami, or do we really love what Swami is there to give? You know, in the sense of what Swami gives materially, in the sense of what Swami gives in the form of protection, in the form of, you know, cure for your illness or alleviation of your pain, whatever. So whether we love Swami or we love what Swami gives.
And after that, you know, we moved on to discussing whether when we say we love Swami and not what Swami gives, is that a one-time decision to make? Is it a one-time event, one-time affair? Or how does it figure when it's put on a balance along with other things, you know? It's easy to say I choose God. But when it comes to, do you choose God or do you choose something else that is dear to you? When it's put in a balance, in isolation it's easy to choose God. But when it's put in a balance against something else that is very dear to us, then what do we do? Those are the maybe moral dilemmas that come up, ethical dilemmas or other dilemmas of choosing between two things that we love. So at that time, do we choose God?
Right.
Which brings us to a point whether choosing God, is it a one-time event or is it a lifelong commitment?
Yeah, not only a lifelong commitment, it's also a lifelong struggle.
Mm.
You know, because it is easy to say, so many times somebody would come and ask, what do you want? And I think we all have been trained to give the answer that, Swami, we want only you.
Hmm.
And somewhere in the heart it's there. It's not like it's a completely an empty statement. But to stick to that statement in every decision in life and in every station in life, I think it's an effort which is an ongoing process. It's not like once done and forgotten.
Dear listeners, at this point, it's a very interesting way that Prem brought up this. The week before that, when we had our last satsang, for example, I remember giving the example of the choice that Arjuna made when he visited Lord Krishna just before the great battle. Mahabharata war.
Right.
That was the time Lord Krishna gave the options to Duryodhana and Arjuna. Duryodhana, as we know, you know, is historically considered as the wicked person and Arjuna is the hero. And so, Lord Krishna says, do you want me or my army? And on one side is Lord Krishna who is not going to pick up arms in the battle. Right. On the other side is his great, massive, brave and famous Narayani Sena, which is known for its ferocious and, you know, they die in the battle. Either they win or they don't come back home. That is the kind of resolve they have, that great army.
In fact, it is the army which has actually given name to Krishna, because even if you see the Mahabharata, Krishna was never a king. He was only a king maker. And he actually had a lot of say because of that army which he had. Very, very powerful and very committed warriors in that army.
Correct. Very right, Prem. And so, Krishna, when he offers this choice, Arjuna says, Lord, I want you. And Duryodhana says, Duryodhana is very happy because he feels, what can one cowherd king, you know, do when he's unarmed? So he's happy with that. And I remember discussing this as an example where you choose God over an apparently powerful and wonderful, majestic, lucrative, worldly choice. But at that time, Prem, you brought up one point which was really very significant. And I feel that you must bring that up, same thing now, because it leads to a very significant point.
Right, you know, once when we were discussing this very example and with a couple of friends, this point came up that it is fine that Arjuna made the choice. But here was Krishna making the choice for the Narayani Sena. He was throwing open, you know, all said and done, Narayani Sena were people who were gathered, and that army was built entirely by Krishna. You know, by his presence. They were all, you might not say devotees of Krishna, but they were all people
very
who were followers,
loyal.
Yeah, followers of Krishna. They committed their life to Krishna. And you know, that was their, devotion or whatever to Krishna. And here was Krishna giving the offer of letting this army fight against him.
Correct.
Because it was an obvious thing. If he's going to place him, opposite
to
the army as a choice, which means he's going to let the army fight against him. And they finally had to fight in the adharmic side. The side which was unrighteous, the side which was wicked. And, you know, imagine the predicament of that army. If God,
they have decided to follow Krishna, they have decided to be led by Krishna, and they have dedicated their life for Krishna, and now Krishna tells them to do something which is so, if I may use the term, akrishna, which is so unlike Krishna, because he is
so
now
saying, yeah, will you do whatever you I tell you to do? And they say, definitely, Lord, okay, fight against me now.
Fight against me. I'm on the side of dharma, because,
and you know very well that is the side which is going to be victorious. And how many choices to make when you are actually walking into your death, literally. And you are, you know, the very principles which you stood by when you, in the army was formed, you're actually going to go against it.
That is a very, very poignant question. What do you do when it is easy to choose? It's easy to choose God over other things. The question was, choosing God in isolation is easy, but what when comparison? Choosing God in comparison with other things is also easy. What when you are not given a choice, but God chooses for you? And God chooses for you something which, in our knowledge, in our day-to-day knowing, appears to be going against what God himself stands for. Mm-hmm. It was literally that. God stood for the Pandavas, Krishna stood for the Pandavas, but he wants his select loyal band of followers who are ready to die for him, to die against him.
And the same thing, and even if you look at Arjuna's choice, you know, where I made that point that it's not just a moment's choice, but it's a lifelong effort. Because so many times in the war, actually Arjuna questions Krishna's moves. And you know, when Arjuna is asked to do something, he says, no, that is not right. That is not the rule of the rules of warfare. And when his son is lost in the battle, he accuses Krishna. You know, the same Arjuna who made that wise choice was actually questioning Krishna in every point. So is there, you know, some kind of discrepancy there in that choice? So it is not just choosing God. It is like staying by that choice all your life.
Well, I guess these questions, a at least we will not be able to conclusively answer, because we have no capacity to either judge or see, but we can just discuss. In this discussion, I remembered one very interesting episode, if I may call it so. Mm-hmm. This was told to me by Professor Nanjundaya sir,
okay.
You know, who was formerly the controller of examinations for the Sri Satsai Institute. Now he is retired. He has settled in Puttaparthi, a very inspiring gentleman.
For a long time he was the translator for Swami's discourse.
And I don't know, he always oozes Swami. Whenever he meets, he greets, he starts speaking about Swami, and he tells something that Swami told in an interview room or Swami told in a discourse, or it's wonderful. So one such occasion, he shared this experience.
Mm-hmm.
He said this was a time when Shri Narayan Kasturi, N. Kasturi, used to be the translator for Bhagwan.
Okay.
And Nanjundaya sir had the chance of, you know, pressing Swami's feet in his chambers. And one day after a discourse, as Bhagwan was seated on the chair and sir was pressing his feet, they heard footsteps coming up the staircase, and they guessed it must be, I mean, sir guessed that it must be Kasturi sir. Swami then told him that it is Kasturi,
mm-hmm.
and asked him, how was his translation today? Now that was a day when, you know, Kasturi sir had made a very powerful translation.
Okay.
There are days, you know, when you do very well, some days are not so good. So that was one of his good days. It was very excellent, and so that is what Nanjundaya sir said, Swami, it was very good, very excellent. Swami said, no, it was not good. That is what you will say. You will say that he is very egoistic. He thinks he knows everything, but silly errors he commits. This kind of ego is not good for him.
Mm-hmm.
It will lead to his downfall. He must rectify himself and his translation. This is what you will say. As Swami completed telling that, Kasturi sir enters and there is a smile on his face.
Okay.
And the same Swami who has advised, so, I mean, when you hear this, you feel that Swami is advising Nanjundaya sir to say so because he wants to keep maybe Kasturi sir's ego under check. That is what is the thing that came into my mind. But this same Swami tells Kasturi, Kasturi, it seems your translation was excellent. Everybody is speaking very highly about your translation.
Okay.
And the beaming Kasturi's smiles grow wider. They grow from ear to ear. He's so happy. And at that time, Swami says, Nanjundaya, what do you think? And Nanjundaya sir says, Swami, it was bad. Swami, so many errors were there. He thinks that he is doing a good job, but that is ego coming in. With ego, the translation can't be done well. And Kasturi sir's face becomes red in embarrassment. He is not able to understand what is this. He is upset. And after hearing the whole outpour, he just turns and proceeds, and whatever he was doing, he goes away from there. And then Swami says, you should never tell him that I told you to tell this. And it was years before he got the permission, and in one occasion when Kasturi sir narrated in a place, in a meeting, an incident where he was put into Nanjundaya sir's position, you know,
okay.
being told something and told to be quiet.
Okay.
After that happened, Nanjundaya sir went and told it to Kasturi sir, telling that this is what had happened. This is Kasturi sir smiled and he said, I know. Now I realize I don't have any ill feeling towards you. But for so many years, so it is not that if you are ready to follow Swami, it will all be, you know, hunky-dory. What will you do if, just like the Narayani Sena was advised by Krishna, if you are advised by Swami to do something that in any other sense of the term is very against Swami. For instance, what if Swami says, from tomorrow onwards, if you really love me, criticize me, speak against me and write against me. If you do so sincerely, then I will know that you love me. Are you ready to do that for me? Am I ready? I don't think so.
No, even as you're telling, talking about Nanjundaya sir, another incident which comes to my mind is what happened to a student, you know. Swami apparently had asked this boy to pursue his MBA. He had finished his, I think, MCOM or something. And Swami said, you do MBA. He was not interested. So he was in that purple patch of his relationship with Swami, you could say. And Swami was very keen on him doing MBA. That was the year MBA was starting. Okay, so Swami said, no, you do MBA, you apply and all that. And then Swami was pushing him to write. And maybe, you know, he had that complacency that Swami will give him the MBA. He doesn't have to put any effort. Because Swami was more keen that he do the course than himself. So he didn't prepare for the exam. And he went and did very badly in the exam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this boy himself narrated this incident to us. And he said, Swami called him one day. And after the results had come, Swami called him. And you know that corner between the bhajan hall door and the interview room door?
Yeah.
Just a small corner. No?
Yeah.
Swami called him there. And literally pushed him towards the wall. Swami asked him, what did you write in the exam?
Uh-huh.
So he said, Swami, I told you I'm not prepared for the exam. I'm not, you know, qualified enough to clear the exam. I said, no, what did you write in that exam? Niku, minus 5 ichnara. They've given you minus 5. You got negative marking. What did you write in that exam? And he said, no, sorry, Swami, I didn't do well. And Swami said, okay, I'll take care. You know, don't worry. You go attend the interview, I'll take care. Okay, so this boy goes for the interview. And obviously he's gone for the interview because Swami has, you know, recommended his name. And there he goes for the interview and he gets blasted by the interview panel.
Okay.
The people, the vice chancellor, the registrar and all of them. And he's kind of asked hundreds of questions and he's literally in tears. And they said, do you think that it's so easy to get an MBA in our university and you take it so lightly? And they shouted at him and literally threw him out of the interview room. And he was sure that he's not going to get his MBA.
Hmm.
So after that, the next day Swami comes and calls him. And Swami asks, what happened? What happened in the interview? So literally in tears, he says, Swami, they did like this and they shouted at me. And Swami said, okay, don't worry, I'll take care. So, and needless to say, that boy gets the seat. Swami gives him the seat. And actually the story behind this is what I came to know from somebody in the ad block. This part I heard from the student himself.
Mm.
And somebody from the ad block said,
the administrative block of the
administrative
university.
Mm. That the day before the interview, Swami called the registrar and Swami asked, how did this boy do in the entrance?
Mm.
And he said, Swami, he's done very badly.
Mm.
And I think there's absolutely no effort got into the exam. Then Swami told the registrar that when he comes for the interview, don't spare him. Okay, be as rude as you can to him. You should make him cry.
Oh, that is Swami's instruction to the registrar.
Swami's instruction to the registrar. And that's exactly what he did. And this boy
did
came.
The registrar tell the boy later on?
No, till today, I don't think the boy knows that this is what happened.
Oh, so now you are the secret link.
So you can imagine that it was, you know, the registrar knew that that boy is going to forever look at him and say that you tried to spoil my
chances
career,
of getting into
the MBA. And Swami gave it to me.
Hmm.
So I think, I mean, there are innumerable instances like this when Swami puts a test kind of, you know, like this, where you will have to willingly go and probably
really
be rude.
A very tough situation, Prem, because if you imagine, we have a concept of God. You know, we feel God stands for this, God stands for this, God stands for
this.
And
we have a concept of a devotee too.
Correct.
In the name of God, what we can do.
Yes. But though we may not understand its import, we also believe in a statement that nothing is impossible for God. We state it. But we do not realize the implications of what that statement means.
Right.
It means that it is possible, therefore, that God can tell you to oppose God himself. Just like Krishna told the Narayani Sena to oppose. And today, when I see the world over, there are some people who criticize Swami, who lash out on a persistent and consistent basis. I sometimes wonder, have they been divinely instructed to do that?
You never know.
Because they have been doing it with the same amount of steadfastness, devotion and dedication that, you know, we consider ourselves to be doing. Because we feel steadfastness, devotion and love is shown when we are able to praise the Lord. With that same thing, they are criticizing the Lord. Kamsa got redeemed, Shishupala got redeemed by incessantly criticizing the Lord. The Lord is such a, what can we say, that philosopher's stone, that his touch is enough in any way, either in criticism or in praise.
Actually, you know, I'm reminded of a very powerful dream one of my seniors had. Narrate that. This boy was studying in the US, you know, he was there to do his research. And in the university where he was studying, there was a notice which said that we have a lecture today in the auditorium, a special lecture. And you know what? The topic was against Swami. In a university in the US, and here was somebody going to come and talk about, you know, that you should not believe in people like Swami.
Oh God.
Okay, and it was put on the notice board and it was open to all the students of the university. And there were a set of boys there, like this brother of ours, who were actually very devoted to Swami, and they were very upset and offended by, you know, such a meeting being arranged. So they got together and they decided that they'll go and speak to the management and have this thing scrapped. And that night, this boy has a dream, okay? And the dream is, they're seated in the auditorium and he sees this person, this guest lecturer, standing at the podium and speaking against Swami. Okay, and he's sitting there with the rest of the boys and boiling within. He said, you know, how can such a thing happen and how can the university encourage such things? And even as these emotions are running through his mind in the dream, the lecture gets over and this person comes down from the stage and walks past the aisle where he was sitting. And even as he was seeing in the dream, he sees that the person turns into Swami and looks at him and says, now you understand, and walks away.
Wow.
Literally saying that don't do anything. Whatever is happening is my doing.
We are so much trained to think that whatever happens, we have to do something. Do something. That the concept of doing nothing, being nothing, seems so passive and negative actually. That, I feel, is a nice way, you know, it's high time already. We bring in today's topic, which is the three zeros.
Right.
What are these three zeros? Because, again, you know, I feel it's nice to introduce it to us through a small episode. Mr. Isaac Tigret, the founder of Hard Rock Cafe and a big time donor for the super speciality hospital in Prashanthi Nilayam.
Right.
He faced a cold treatment period. You know, all devotees will be aware of this.
Best thing is the first time he comes, the way he comes is very beautiful. He says that for so many years, he keeps hearing a voice from within, saying that I'm waiting for you, I'm waiting for you, I'm waiting for you. And he goes to many ashrams, meets many holy men, and, you know, he never feels that this was the...
that connection.
This was the person who was calling me. And when he comes to Swami, the first time he comes, you know, he comes to Vrindavan, he's standing in
black and black suit.
Black and black with black shades. And in the end of the... just leaning on the wall. And Swami comes, parting the crowd, comes straight to him, and Swami says, I've been waiting for you for long.
And materialize vibhuti and gives it to him.
And he says, you've finally come. We have a lot of work to do.
And he makes a connection instantly. And after that, for the next decade or so...
15 years.
15 years. Swami doesn't even interact with him in any manner. And when he was asked, you know, what did he feel? You're given such a rousing welcome. And after that, for 15 years, nothing. He said, I really did not feel anything because I knew the concept of the three zeros. So, well, dear listeners, that is the importance of this concept. Knowing this concept is so uplifting. It gives us so much more deeper insight and understanding. So, Prem, if I were to ask you on behalf of all our listeners, what is this concept of the three zeros? How will you explain that?
I think those three zeros can be any three zeros. I think you can put any three top most important things in your life in that three spots. But just generalizing them and giving the general three zeros, let me re-narrate that incident where Swami spoke about those three zeros.
Yes.
When a devotee very casually told Swami, I think it was during darshan and Swami was walking by, and Swami had a conversation with her, and at the end of that, she just said, Swami, I only pray for your grace. And Swami, who had already started walking, stopped, turned back, came to her and said, what did you ask? And she just said, I didn't ask anything wrong. I said, Swami, give me your grace. I just want your grace. I said, do you know what it is to get my grace? And Swami said, are you prepared to go through the three zeros? If you are ready to go through the three zeros, at the end of it, you'll get my grace. And then Swami said, the first zero is the zero of wealth, if you still love me. The second zero is the zero of relationships and friendships, all your contacts. And the third zero is the zero of fame. Your name.
Fame. Self-respect.
Your self-respect. And if you're ready to go through these three zeros, then you will get me and my grace.
Which means, if tomorrow your wealth becomes zero, and at that time if you say, Swami, I don't want wealth, I want you. And then comes the next zero where your relationships, your friendships come to naught. When they become zero and you say, Swami, I don't care for them, I want you. And then your own self-respect, the thing that everyone holds most dear to them, their own concept of themselves. That itself...
What others think you are, which is so important for us.
Correct. Then that itself comes down to zero. And then you still say, Swami, that is not important. I love you. That is when we are ready to receive His grace. We shall discuss more about this on the other side of this short break. And in this break, we play a small song which amplifies this feeling that, Lord, you are everything, everything else is a zero without you.
Man mero lage na tere bina saaye, man mero lage na tere bina saaye. दर्शन के प्यासे अखियां, तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी, जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साईं मेरे, जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साईं मेरे, मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे, लागे ना तेरे बिना छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले, तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले, नयन कमल मन मोहक मादक रंजित है अधरारे, तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले, इस छवि को हम मन में भर कर तेरे गुण को गाए, तेरे गुण को गाए, मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे, मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे। तेरे बिना जग माया काए, बंधन टूट न पाए।
Yes, Arvind. So let's continue in our discussion over this three zeros. the first zero, the zero of wealth. I think it's a very common thing. In fact, you know, once I was talking to a devotee who used to come in the 1960s.
Oh, okay.
Literally, I think Swami had a name that if you go to him, he might take away all your wealth.
Oh, okay.
People had that fear. And you know, if you look at it that way, most of these Swamijis, no disrespect meant to anybody, the thing, their USP, the unique selling proposition or whatever, you know, is that they will alleviate all your pain. But here was Swami who had the name that, you know, if you go to him, he might get more troubles. But the number of followers who came to Swami just kept increasing. Because I think Swami never minced words. Swami never said, I will give you whatever you want. Swami always said, I'll give you what you want.
What you need.
Only so that one day I can give you what you really have to get from me.
And Swami has said it time and again in his discourses that, you know, untruth shivers at every shadow. But truth has nothing to fear. And his name itself stood for truth, Satya Sai. So he did not mince words, as you said. And in spite of that, you know, in spite of that, it has happened. It has happened. You know, when I was just thinking about this, when you see the world over, you know, there have been occasions where people don't like a leader. They have even thrown a boot at him. You know, they have stood up and shouted and spoken against him. On his face, when he or she is walking out of some place, there are people surrounding him and talking against him. I used to think that if there is so much opposition actually for Swami as such, not a single occasion where somebody has stood up and told, Swami, you're a cheat. Swami, you're this. Swami, never. And Swami used to walk unarmed with nobody amidst the huge crowds. Nobody, because I feel even if, as we discussed during, you know, they came, they saw, they got conquered. When we discussed during that, they came, they saw, he conquered. Even people who came with objectives to so-called bash up or malign Swami, once they saw Swami, they were just won over. And it is not because of his physical beauty. It is not because of his charming voice or anything. It is because of something, something magical that the heart, only the heart understands, because of which his face becomes beautiful, his voice becomes melodious, everything about him becomes beautiful. Adharam madhuram, nayanam madhuram, vadanam madhuram, hasitam madhuram. As the Madhurashtakam says for Lord Krishna, I feel that is the thing about avatars. Krishna is dark, and yet everybody glorifies his beauty because there is something magical. There is that inner beauty because of which every aspect, everything about them becomes beautiful. And I think I have taken off a digression.
No, and actually, though it is a digression, it's leading to what a story I would like to narrate. You know, talking of the three zeros, how Swami would put devotees through the zero of wealth.
Okay.
It's happened before. It's happened with a couple of devotees. And the devotee I would like to mention here is a person by name Balapattabhi. He's a very old person. I don't know. I think he's still alive. We had the opportunity to interview him. He was actually post-90 at that time. We sent somebody to Chennai where he was living and had his interview recorded in his house. This person came to Swami in 1945.
1945. Swami was not even in his 20s then.
Yeah, Swami was very young, and you can imagine coming to Parthi that year. He was a couple of years older to Swami when he came. And the story goes that, you know, he was a very rich businessman. He had jaggery business in a town called Udumalpet in Tamil Nadu. So the only problem he had was he didn't have any children even after 10 years of marriage.
Okay.
So he comes to know about Swami. He comes to hear that there is one person near Bangalore who is called Satya Sai Baba and who is doing all kinds of amazing things. So his brother-in-law tells him that, you know, maybe he is a person you can try your problem with. You know, because he wanted a child. And he was actually going from one pilgrim center to the other. So his brother-in-law says, why don't you come and see Swami? Because his brother-in-law had seen Swami, and the moment he had seen, he had become a devotee of Swami. So he was getting more and more people to Swami. So it so happened that a bus of about 40 people.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but isn't that a common thing that happens? we come and once we are bowled over, oh God, I want to make the whole world into devotees because I feel it is such a beneficial thing.
Right, the joy which we experience, we want everybody else to experience.
Yeah, so I can...
That's what happened, you know. So he convinced his sister, she was Balapatabi's wife, she was enamored even by hearing about Swami. So she convinces her husband and very reluctantly he comes. He says, you know, why do we have to go after these people? And imagine 60-year-old Swami was just 16 years old and here was Puttaparthi, which was like nobody else knew other than maybe people in Bukapattam. That was how remote Puttaparthi was. And they come in a bus, about 40 of them come together. And imagine those days, if there was a retinue like this coming, Swami would be at the gate to receive the group of devotees coming. And each devotee would come and garland Swami and take Swami's Pad Namaskar, and Swami would call them inside. So this bus of 40 people, each one procured a garland, and they land up in Old Mandir. And when they stand in a queue and each one comes and offers a garland, and Swami welcomes them.
16-year-old Swami.
Okay.
A boy.
Yeah, a 16-year-old Swami. And here Mr. Balapatabi comes with his garland. And yeah, before that what happens is the moment he sees Swami as he alights from the bus, he loses his heart to Swami, who is so beautiful and something, as you said, you know, something magical about his presence. It's not just the look.
Yes, Prem, how many we have seen, you know? Yes, Prem, I think that is that. The answer is that Prem. The Prema that he embodies, people just come and, you know, if I can use the word, shamelessly, without any inhibitions, pledge their heart to him.
Right, and that's exactly what happened to Mr. Balapatabi. The moment he saw Swami, he was drawn to Swami. And when he goes to Swami to garland him, Swami says, I don't want you garland. He says, you didn't want to come here, then I don't want you garland. Like a little child, you
Outing
know,
child.
Who's hurt by your act. You know? He said, I don't want you garland, you go away. You didn't want to come here. So Balapatabi says he was so hurt by it, you know, he goes behind the building and starts crying. You know, here was a 30-odd-year-old businessman who didn't want to come here and was so childlike, you know, in his tears when he was not accepted. Okay, and so, and the thing happens that later Swami calls him and puts an arm around his shoulder and says, don't cry, don't worry. I just wanted to show you that I know everything. I know what is running in your mind. But nobody is, you know, unwelcome in my mandir. And embraces him, and Swami tells him a very beautiful thing after that. Swami says, see, you know, 40 of you have come, right? All these people will leave me. These people will not have constant faith in me. Only you and your wife will stay.
Oh.
And he's surprised. He said, I'm the only non-devotee in this group and my wife may be a neutral person. But here Swami is saying that all of them will leave. They will not be able to stand my test. Only you and your wife will stay. And okay, and this is what happens. And later in the evening, that same day, Swami calls Balapatabi and takes him for a walk, all alone. Okay, and takes him into the darkness. And Swami materializes, a chain or what do you call that, kind of a twine which they tie around so that no evil comes to you.
Okay, kind of, where they tie around the waist or the wrist?
The wrist.
Okay, huh.
Okay, I think something like that Swami materializes for him and ties it. And Swami holds his hand and as though Swami is giving a promise, Swami says, whatever happens, I will not let go of you. I will always be there for you. I will always be there
soul.
For you.
What a blessed soul.
Okay, and at one side, Balapatabi is really moved by this gesture of Swami. Literally, Swami is giving a promise. Swami is putting his palm in his palm and saying that, I will not leave you, I will not leave you. Okay, and whatever happens to you, I will not leave you. And the other side, he was wondering, what is going to happen to me? I have a flourishing business and I am doing pretty well. The only problem is I don't have a child. But there is nothing impending for Swami to give me a promise like what he is giving me now.
Yeah.
So he was confounded a bit, but you know, he was so happy to receive this benediction from Swami. And needless to say, that's what happened. Slowly his business, for no reason, started getting a downturn. He started losing money, he started losing in his business. And, you know,
it's not that he gave money to Swami.
Right.
No.
It's not like Swami snatched away his money or anything. It's just that his business, you know, it never appeared like it was going to happen. All of a sudden, his business started collapsing and he had a lot of debts. And, you know, there's one very interesting incident. He says that he decides to run away from the country.
For?
Because he's not able to manage the problems he's having. So he decides to board a ship and go away to Malaysia or somewhere. And he says that he's not told anybody. And he decides he'll write back to his wife later saying that I'm in Malaysia after he's well settled. So this is his idea. So from his town, he goes to Chennai. He stays in one of his customers' house. And from there he goes to this dock, you know, the harbor, to board the ship. So he takes 200 rupees with him to buy the ticket. And when he goes there, somebody picks his pocket. He loses the money. So he says, okay, I'll go back and I'll maybe borrow some money from this, my host, and I'll try again. When he comes back to the house, there is a letter for him addressed to that person.
Okay. Why?
And he says, you have a letter. And he's surprised. He said, a letter for me here? Nobody knows I'm here. The moment he sees the envelope and he sees that handwriting, he realizes it's Swami. Because it's in Swami's handwriting. And, you know, he's not able to read the letter. There's tears in his eyes. He opens the letter and there Swami has written, go back to your home, go back to your home. I will not leave you, I will not leave you. Whatever happens, I'll be with you. And, you know, he's so overwhelmed by this. He doesn't go home. He actually comes to Patti. Okay, he comes running to Patti. And when he comes to Patti, Swami doesn't look at him.
Oh my God.
Okay, and he says that he gives up food for 3 days. He doesn't eat and all that. But Swami doesn't relent. Swami doesn't look at him at all. So finally he decides, he writes a letter to Swami saying that, Swami, you're my final destination. So if you will that the time to part is now, so be it. I'm leaving my body. I'm giving up my life.
So did he try suicide?
Yeah, so he writes a letter, leaves it outside Swami's door, and he goes to the nearby well, and he says, no, he jumps into the well. He writes in this book, you know, this experience. He says, like...
Which book is this?
One book about his experience, it's written as Baba Satisai by Raghunapati, one of the popular books in the devotee circle. And the other thing is, he himself has written a book. I'm not too sure about the title of the book. I think... Nectarine Leelas or Divine Leelas of Sat Sai Baba. So there he writes, when he jumps into the well, you know, almost like somebody is pulling him out of the well, physically. Like, you know, when you fish, you're pulled out. He says he's not able to reach the water. He's pulled out of the well and he's dragged to Swami's room. And the next moment he realizes he's sitting in Swami's presence.
My God.
And Swami again reprimands him, and Swami says, I didn't talk to you because I told you to go home and you came to Patti. And Swami tells you, go, trust in me. Whatever happens, I'll be with you. And needless to say, you know, he goes back home. It's not like his problem solved overnight. But the beauty is, he says in one point in the book, you know, when they're going through all this, he and his wife sit down and decide, no, what do we do? Do we listen to the Swami or not? And then they kind of review all their things, all their incidents which have happened in their life ever since they went to Swami. And they say that it's definitely worth believing in Swami. And whatever happens, we'll hold on to him.
That is one beautiful thing, Prem, across the board. You see, whether it's in a worldly sense a happy experience or a sad experience. Today, you know, that day when we were discussing not only our joys, but many times when we felt our hearts were also broken. Right, with respect to matters regarding to Swami. But in spite of all that, when we look back at those, all those themselves have become reasons why we love Swami so much. Right. I mean, with Swami, the so-called positive and the negative both together reinforce why we love Swami. And I feel that shows the other, you know, the other perspective about the three zeros. One way is to think that, you know, you come to Swami, you seek God and you lose everything else. But the actual, I feel this is the actual perspective, that it is not that you lose everything. Once you get to know Swami, once you get to know God, the other things automatically become zeros. Wealth does not matter. Relationship does not matter. Speaking of that, I'm reminded of the famous story that Swami has narrated in discourses. It is also recorded, you know, by other sources. About how once Lord Krishna decided to feign a headache.
Okay.
You know, he said his head was aching severely and all the physicians were called, you know, and the celestial sage Narada also comes and everybody tries all their therapies and cures. Nothing works. Lord Krishna's splitting headache remains. Finally, Lord Krishna says, I will tell you the medicine that will cure me. The medicine that will cure me is the dust from the feet of a devotee.
Okay.
Once you apply the dust from the feet of a devotee onto my forehead, my headache will be cured. So can you get it? Now immediately, sage Narada moves back. You know, he says, how can I take the dust from my feet and apply it on the forehead of my Lord? What will happen? You know, this is in according to the relationship, between the Lord and the devotee. This is sacrilege. So Narada does not want to do it. So do so many others. They tell Lord Krishna is like our guru. This is like disrespect from a disciple to the guru to take dust from his feet and apply it onto the guru's head. So nobody is ready to go against that relationship. Then Lord Krishna tells Narada, you go to the Gopikas in Vrindavan. And when Narada goes to the Gopikas, without a moment's hesitation, without a moment hesitation, the Gopikas simply lift their feet, dust it off, take the dust and tell, please give this to our Lord as fast as possible and convey to us the good news that his headache is cured. When it came to that, the Gopikas did not care about what will happen, whether they are committing a sin, whether that will make them, you know, downgrade their evolution. Nothing mattered. Whether their relationship will go, whether they are breaking, nothing mattered, nothing mattered. They lived for Krishna and that's all it is needed to be said about their life.
Right.
So you see, it is not that because of their love for Krishna, they lost all their relationship. It is not that the Gopikas did not care for their husband, did not bother about anything else because Krishna made them love. It is not in that negative sense. But having realized the value of the gem that Lord Krishna is, everything else felt like a zero. And that is what Swami tells us in the discourse, you know. He says, everything in the world, everything is a zero, 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 zero. They all gain value when digit one, which is God, is placed next to them. God next to all these zeros and each zero seems to add more value. But you remove that one, remove God, add how many ever millions of zeros you want. No value. The value remains the same, which is zero.
And talking about the Gopikas, you know, there's one beautiful Padyam which Swami says, of course I can't quote it verbatim, the meaning of which is Swami says that, you know, the mother-in-laws of these Gopikas, they curse them. You know, they kind of mouthfuls of abuses for their behavior. Their husbands draw swords and try to stop them. But the moment they hear the flute, you know, the sound of the flute coming from the Yamuna banks, they leave everything and run over there. They never cared for their fame. They never cared for what people will say. You know, that's how great their devotion was. And talking about the zero of fame, you know, I think as late as in 2001, during a Ramnavami discourse, Swami spoke about Kaikeyi. And I think in that series of discourses, Swami spoke about some very, very little spoken about characters of Ramayana. And one of those characters was Kaikeyi. Swami said, why did Kaikeyi ask for those three boons? And Swami narrated that a day before that event happened, when she went...
Before that, Prem, I think a brief introduction, the Ramayana is an immortal epic where Lord Rama, an avatar of Lord Vishnu, comes down to earth to annihilate the demons and the Rakshasas, mainly Ravana.
Right.
And Lord Rama has three other brothers who have been begotten from two other mothers. So King Dasharatha, who is Rama's father, has three wives, Kausalya, Kaikeyi and Sumitra. And Lord Rama is the eldest, the son of the eldest queen, Kausalya. And Kaikeyi is the second queen and her son is the second.
Right.
You know, he is the second prince. Right. And therefore, the story goes that just as Rama is about to be crowned as the king, the crown prince of Ayodhya, Kaikeyi goes to her husband Dasharatha and says that you have promised me two boons anytime that I want in return for the services that I have rendered to you. I now seek my two boons. And then Dasharatha says, ask whatever you want. The first boon she asks for is, instead of Rama, my son Bharata should be made king.
Right.
And the second boon is, Rama should be sent to the forest, Dandakaranya forest, that is infested with these demons for a period of 14 years. These are the two boons. And King Dasharatha is heartbroken. And the Ramayana progresses that way. Bharata also decides that he doesn't want to rule. So he keeps Rama's footwear on the throne and he becomes like, you know, a proxy ruler. Lord Rama goes for the exile for 14 years, during which he annihilates all the demons and in the end kills Ravana and then returns back to the kingdom. So in all the traditional Ramayanas, Kaikeyi is painted as the villainess who was responsible for this whole Ramayana coming through.
Right.
And yes, Prem, now we can continue with that discourse.
Yeah, and in that discourse, you know, Swami narrated this very, very revealing incident. Swami says the day before she goes and asks for these two boons, Rama comes to the presence of Kaikeyi and kind of lays before her the plans for his entire avataric life. And he says, this is what I've come for. Okay, and he said, I cannot do all this remaining a king of Ayodhya if I become a king. And there might be so many other conditions which called for him to take that decision. So Rama says that I have to go to the forest. And Rama says, will you help me? So Kaikeyi says that anything for you, Rama, whatever you ask for. So then...
And Swami, I remember he said that Kaikeyi loved Rama much more than his own mother loved him.
Right.
And therefore, Rama goes to Kaikeyi and says, I know your love for me.
I know only you can do this for me. And he says that these are the two boons you have to ask. You have to ask that I be sent away to the forest. And she says, if that is what you want me to do, fine, I will do it. And then Rama tells her that you know the implications of this act of yours.
He says, for centuries to come.
He said, your own son will hate you first. Are you ready to do? She said, yes, if this is what you want me to do, I will do it. And he says, for centuries to come, as you were saying, nobody will even name a child after you. That's how infamous you will be.
Because you will become the villainous.
You will become the most wretched person in the whole of Ramayana. Are you ready to do? He says, yes. He says, your own husband, because in the Ramayana it is said that Kaikeyi was the favorite queen of Dasharatha. He says, the husband who sees you as his favorite will start hating you. You might even lose him. Are you still ready to do? And she says, if this is what you want me to, this is the role you want me to play, I am ready to play. That was her love for the Lord.
You know, it is almost thousands of years later
that
the Lord redeems her. The Lord is Kala Kala Yanama Kala Tita. He is beyond time. But in human years, if we measure it, till Swami revealed it, even I too, today I have such great respect for Kaikeyi. And you know, some people, of course, they say that this is not there in the Ramayana. My answer is, listen, Rama knows best. Naturally, Valmiki didn't know. This is some secret that only Rama and Kaikeyi knew. And that is why Sai Rama is revealing it. And these are the subtle things that Swami reveals. And when we talk of it as a third zero, where, you know, your own, you will fall in the eyes of those who actually love you and respect you and revere you. But even that should not be as important to you as your love for the Lord. And that is the kind of love that Kaikeyi had. So much so that for all the students, for all the devotees, for everybody, this is what is recorded even in the Ramakatha Rasavahini. It was as late as 2001 that in the discourse that Swami revealed that Kaikeyi is not the greatest villainess, but the greatest heroine, devotee. Greatest devotee, who sacrificed everything, including her own self-respect. See, but there is a hint, you know, in the Valmiki Ramayana, if you see, the next day itself, Kaikeyi is there in the entourage, which goes and falls at Rama's feet. Kaikeyi, the mother, the other two mothers don't. But Kaikeyi goes and falls at Rama's feet and says, Rama, please come back. Please come back. You know, this you can see is the devotee in Kaikeyi. I have done it because my Lord wants it to be done. But now, Lord, I want you back. Please come back. Please come back. Lord Rama just smiles and sends her back. If at all, if it was anger, if it was her vile cunningness that made her banish Rama, would she the next day rush and fall at Rama's feet, requesting him and begging him to come back? But you know, that puts into perspective. Now, Prem, now let us ask ourselves, do we seek Swami? When we seek Swami, it is not that we will be given a choice to choose between God and the others. A choice will be made for us. Will we be ready to accept it? Not only accept it, will we be able to cherish it and, you know, be excited about it and live up to it? Wow, that is a real big ask. No wonder it is said that the Lord is constantly in search of a devotee. Because it often seems funny. God, all the devotees have only one God. You have so many devotees. No. Just as you are in search of your Lord, the Lord too is in search of a devotee.
I think that is the transition that every devotee makes, because it is the difference between you having a God to the state of God having you. Because we all come to Swami because we want Him. We want the glorious things which He stands for. But are we ready to give ourselves to Him? And if we are ready to give ourselves to Him, then we have to go through something what Khalil Gibran describes in his poem, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
About love.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most beautiful pieces ever written on this.
And I'm very grateful to the Swami in Prem for having pointed out this poem to me. Dear listeners, this is so beautiful. I mean, if you just close your eyes now and listen to what I'm going to read out and just picturize Swami there, Swami speaking this to us, at different parts of the poem, at different points in the poem, we will be able to empathize and feel, yes, oh yes, this is so right. That is what Prem felt. That is why he showed it to me. And that is what I too felt. And here I am. I start reading it out. Please, just close your eyes. Bring in Swami in your mind's eye. And just picturize Him telling this to you. When love beckons to you, follow Him. Though His ways are hard and steep, and when His wings enfold you, yield to Him. Though the sword hidden among His pinions may wound you. And when He speaks to you, believe in Him. Though His voice may shatter your dreams, as the north wind lays waste the garden. For even as love crowns you, so shall He crucify you. For even as He is for your growth, so is He for your pruning. Even as He ascends to your height and caresses your tenderest branches that quiver in the sun, so shall He descend to your roots and shake them in their clinging to the earth. Like sheaves of corn, He gathers you unto Himself. He threshes you to make you naked. He sifts you to free you from your husks. He grinds you to whiteness. He kneads you until you are pliant. And then He assigns you to His sacred fire, that you may become sacred bread for God's sacred feast.
All these things shall love do unto you, that you may know the secrets of your heart, and in that knowledge become a fragment of life's heart. But if in your fear you would seek only love's peace and love's pleasure, then it is better for you that you cover your nakedness and pass out of love's threshing floor into the seasonless world, where you shall laugh, but not all your laughter, and weep, but not all your tears. Love gives not but itself, and takes not but from itself. Love possesses not, nor would it be possessed, for love is sufficient unto love. When you love, you should not say, God is in my heart, but rather, I am in the heart of God. And think not you can direct the course of love, for love, if it finds you worthy, directs your course.
Love has no other desire but to fulfill itself. But if you love and must needs have desires, let these be your desires. To melt and be like a running brook that sings its melody to the night. To know the pain of too much tenderness. To be wounded by your own understanding of love, and to bleed willingly and joyfully. To wake up at dawn with a winged heart and give thanks for another day of loving. To rest at the noon hour and meditate love's ecstasy. To return home at eventide with gratitude. And then to sleep with a prayer for the beloved in your heart and a song of praise upon your lips.
Really beautiful, isn't it, Arvind? And what powerful words. And I think it kind of summarizes all what we wanted to say about love, because here, not only the pleasant emotions of love, where, you know, he says that even as he ascends to your heights and caresses your tenderest branches that quiver in the sun, so shall he descend to your roots and shake them in their clinging to the earth. Because that's the role of love, you know, even as love.
Even that statement, you know, it brings the image of Jesus Christ in the mind.
Right.
He says, even as love crowns you, so shall He crucify you.
Absolutely.
I mean, Jesus was crowned and yet crucified, and both are two sides of the same coin. So, I mean, as we discussed, it is better to read this out, because it is so tough to put the same thing into better words.
And even these words, which, you know, one of my favorite actually, and when his wings enfold you, yield to him, though the sword hidden among his pinions may wound you. You know, that yield to that embrace, but you know, there is a sort of pain in that embrace, you know, which might hurt you, but it's good for you.
And the most powerful message from all this, I feel, think not you can direct the course of love.
Absolutely.
For love, if it finds you worthy, will direct your course. We just have to make ourselves worthy of his love. Our course will automatically be directed. And if I look at myself, I feel all the while I am trying to direct the course of this love with him. Oof, what a powerful message it is. Just make yourselves worthy. Everything else will be directed. And all this comes back to our topic, Prem, which is again of the three zeros, because we somehow find consolation, we find joy, we find whatever only in action. In doing something. The concept of nothingness, being nothing, just, you know, sheer existence and nothing else is so uncomfortable. It feels so lazy. It feels so lethargic. It feels so negative. But you know, I remember one discourse just 3 days back, I think it was on the occasion of Shivratri, it was being played on Radio Sai. In that discourse, Swami so beautifully said it, you know. He said, if I tell you to close your eyes and close them real tight, shut them. And then, what do you see? The answer is, we see darkness. And then Swami said, you never say that I don't see anything. You say, I see darkness, I see blackness, I see nothingness. So that means, you know, Swami says that it is not as if there is light and there is an absence of light. There is light, there is dark. There are two sides. These are the two sides that come in the dual world, joys and sorrows. It is not as if the lack of joy is sorrow. There is joy, there is sorrow. There is light, there is darkness. They are all two things. And then Swami said, you have a light within that is able to see the light, that is able to see the darkness when you close the eyes. That is the true light. That is the Atma Jyoti. So, just as, you know, we take something or anything as a thing, nothing is also a thing. You know, it's just like two sides of the same coin.
And how many times you've heard Swami saying that, you know, putting out his empty hand and saying, asking what is there in this. And when the answers comes that there is nothing, Swami says that there is everything and there is nothing. And I think we should play that small clip from a discourse which was delivered, I think, in 1986. Again, it was a Shivratri discourse where Swami was talking about this concept of nothing. A very profound clip. I think we should play that today.
Yes.
Nature is God. That is why we have to just see whatever you see is God. Nature itself is God.
Anything is God.
Energy itself is God.
Nothing is God.
Nothing also is God. It is not nothing.
There is everything.
What you call nothing is not really nothing. It is everything.
Manam nothing, nothing and it will start on Anni ibidi buttunnai.
In what we call nothing, everything is hidden and
apparent. Everything and it will start on nothing gautunnai.
What you call everything, in fact there is nothing.
Everything is nothing. Nothing is everything.
Meaning, some substance of it is everything is nothing.
Everything. Anni untunnai, anni untunnai manam aashapadutunnamu. Chala parapatu, idi nothing.
Take for example this world. We think that everything is in this world, but truly speaking, this is nothing.
Daivam ledu, daivam ledu, daivam ledu. Akkada nothing, nothing antunnaru. Kani everything akkade untundi.
We say that there is no God, and God is nothing. But everything is in God, truly speaking.
Munnadaram ledani cheptunnadu thanu, paapam nastikudu.
An atheist declares that God doesn't exist.
There is no God.
He says that there is no God.
There is modalochindi. No God next ochindi.
In this sentence there is no God. the first part, there is a declaration has come first. కాబట్టి ఉన్నదానం చేయించున్నాను తాను. An atheist is one who is denying what is existing.
God is blind.
He is blind. An atheist is blind.
So succinctly put, Prem, and it's so sweet to hear Swami say, nothing is everything and everything is nothing. You know, this concept is so profound. I remember reading a short story, you know. The short story was about an orchestra competition that takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And after the competition, there are four teams that perform. And everybody is discussing, you know, who should be the winner. Whether it's team A or team B or team C or team D.
Okay.
And the discussion goes on and everybody feels that team B should win.
Mm-hmm.
The decision is common among all the people who are discussing. But the reasons they give is different. You know, somebody says that team B, you know, I think is the winner because their chords were so beautiful. Somebody else says, I think team B is the winner because the ragas that they used, you know, the notes that they used were so rich. Somebody else says, I think team B is the winner because their music matched the theme so perfectly and various other reasons. And at that time, there is a person who is considered as the musical icon of that place.
Mm-hmm.
And as he is walking by, they just go to him. He has also attended this competition. He has just been one among the audience. And so, seeing him, all these four boys who are discussing, they rush up to him and they say, sir, what do you think? Who do you think will be the winner of this competition? He just closes his eyes for a moment and he says, I feel that the winner will be team B.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is so happy because, you know, their judgment matches the judgment of the icon, the star, the superstar, you know, you feel great. And they say, ah, yes, sir, we knew it, sir, because, you know, I felt that the chords were so harmonic over there. And the other person says, yes, because, you know, the ragas they used. And again, all of them says their reasons. Then this icon says, you know, this legend, he says that if it was ragas, then I think team A did a better job of it. If you're talking about the way they blended the chords, I think team D did a better job. If you think about relevance of the theme and the music, I think team C did a better job. But team B will win the prize. Now, you know, they were all shocked because the decision was right, but the reasons for the decision seemed wrong. And then this legend says that team B wins because of the rich silence between the notes of their piece. And he walks away. And then, you know, this brings up a very, very poignant the author of the story brings up this point so powerfully that we often think that music is a series of notes. Music is not just notes. Music is a series of notes interspersed with zones of silence.
Silence.
As important is the melody, that important is the silence. You know, you see it so many times happening in so many movies. Sometimes, at the climax of a scene that is taking place, there is just deadbeat silence. No amount of loud, jarring or hitting music can build up that impact of the silence over there. Silence is being used. They don't say that, don't put any music. They say, put silence here. And that is why, even if you give a great speech, for example, a thunderous applause is a sure sign of success.
Right.
But in the world, you see that a stunned, stupefied silence is considered as a greater applause than a deafening applause itself. They say that there was a deafening silence. What an oxymoron, but there's a very poignant point here. That music is not just notes, it is also the silence between the notes. If we translate that into our day-to-day life, we think that our life is a series of activities. It's activity, and therefore our happiness, our joy, everything is based on activity. But it is not so. It is not so because if we are unable to find joy in inactivity, then we can never be truly joyful because life is 50% activity and 50% inactivity, just as music is 50% the melody and 50% the silence between the notes. So nothingness is actually everything in that sense, because that is what gives music. if those silences are not there, there's no music at all. So when Swami says nothing is everything, this is what we realize. I mean, I felt this story is very relevant over here.
You know, indeed, actually, what we call beats, what we call rhythm, is nothing but, you know, one way of seeing it is a sound which repeats itself in regular intervals.
Sound separated by silences.
Yeah, but actually it might be silence which is
separated by sounds,
which is repeating itself in regular intervals.
Wow, yes.
And I think everything is like that, you know. Swami always makes this point. There's the innumerable Chinnakathas where Swami says that you don't have to go out in search of silence. Because we always think that silence is always outside, you know. That is why the concept of going into the forest and doing meditation. Because actually the silence which we have to seek is, Swami says that, can you see silence in the noise? Can you see solitude in a crowd? Swami says that is what is important. You have to be in solitude even when you are in a crowd.
Going logically, by our discussion, it is so easy to see sound in silence. When there is absolute silence, even a pin drop is heard. Then going by that, it should be as easy to sense the silence when there is so much noise.
Exactly.
In fact, when there is so much noise, when there is so much of silence, just as a sound stands out, when there is so much noise, that is when the silence will stand out. And that is why maybe we are all put into the world. And Swami says, therefore be of the world, but do not let the world enter you. Maybe there is a reason why we are put into this so-called noise. Because maybe the only way to discover that silence is amidst the noise, just as we are able to discover the noise when it's absolutely silent.
Exactly. You know, talking of this concept, reminded of a Chinnakatha which Swami used to say, and very dramatically Swami would narrate it. I'm not capable of that, but at least we share it. Where, you know, there is this man who is given to bad temper. And his wife always keeps telling him that you have very ill temper, you're short-tempered. So one fine day he says that, okay, I'm going to set out now and conquer this temper of mine and come back. Okay, and he goes away into the forest. And for months he's meditating and doing penance there to conquer this anger. And finally one day he comes back and he declares to his wife, I've conquered my anger. Okay, and she says, are you sure? I mean, you've conquered your anger? He says, yeah, I've conquered my anger. I'll never get angry, you know. And she again asks, you sure you've conquered your anger? You really mean you've conquered your anger? He says, yeah, I've conquered my anger. I mean, are you really sure that you've conquered my anger? And he bursts out and says, yes, I've conquered my anger. And, you know, Swami goes on to say that what is the point in going out where there's nobody and trying to control yourself and control your anger? Be where it is needed. Be where equanimity is needed. Be where, you know, sweet temper is needed, and cultivate that.
Like the other saying that goes, a ship was not meant to be in a harbor.
Right. Though it spends most of its time in the harbor.
Its quality is measured when it's able to sail out in the sea. So too, silence doesn't mean cutting away and going, as you said. It is in the crowd when you're able to keep the silence. And two very powerful points here, Prem. One is, true silence can be measured only when you're able to keep it in the crowd. And the second thing, I mean, this, as we had this discussion, as you said, it struck somewhere within me, and that's why I'm so excited about this fact that the reciprocal must hold true. If we are able to discover even the slightest sound when there's absolute silence, we will be able to discover that magical silence when there's absolute chaos and sound everywhere else.
Absolutely.
Because that's the reciprocal, that's like the mirror image. Wow, so many thoughts
But you know, coming back to this topic of zeros, nothingness, I think, you know, what, putting in context with what we spoke in the last couple of minutes, I think it is important is to remove that fear of that zero, remove that fear of that nothingness. When Swami says three zeros, it's not necessarily meaning that Swami is going to rip you of your wealth and Swami is going to take away all that you is dear to you. It is not necessarily that. I think Swami puts us through a process where you say that this is a zero. It is not necessarily you go to a zero account balance, you know, anything like that. You go through a certain set of experiences where you look back and say that this is a zero for me. You look at fame and name and you say this is a zero for me. You look at all your friends and the people who flock around you and say this is a zero for me. the only reality is Swami. I think that is the process, and that is what we are saying, you know, that see, listening to that silence in a noise, being in solitude in a crowd, I think that is what it is. When you're able to negate what is, what you actually earlier felt was reality. That is what is important. I think that is the process that Swami is putting us all through. And the other day I was thinking, you know, if you take the example of Ramana Maharshi, Ramana Maharshi said that you're not the body. You know, you're beyond the body, and the pain of the body will not hurt you. Let us say somebody who is suffering from some pain comes to Ramana Maharshi, and Ramana Maharshi says that, what will that person's reaction be? He'll say that, what do you know of pain?
What do you know of pain? Yeah, it's easy for you to sit there and talk.
It's easy for you to say, I'm having the pain. So I think it was necessary for somebody like Ramana to go through that pain and show and live that message which he had come to give.
That's exactly what Swami did.
And that's exactly what Swami did, and that's exactly what Swami is letting many devotees do in their lives. It is not enough if Swami just imparts equanimity to them. Swami also gives them an opportunity to express that equanimity in their life when Swami puts them through, you know, these three zeros or whatever difficulty Swami puts them through. So I think it is essentially a part of
it's like
his message.
It is like two things, Prem. I feel the one message that we can take out of this is that we should not consider sorrowful times or painful times as a lack of something.
Right.
It's almost like, say, a white cat and a black cat. Sometimes it's a white cat, sometimes it's a black cat. It's not that God's grace is lacking and therefore it is like this. God's grace is there and therefore, I mean, like when you spoke of Balapattabhi, everyone says that, you know, I came to Swami and ever since then my business has grown and this, and you feel that. But if you say, I came to Swami and, you know, my, can we tell, I came to Swami and, you know, after that my business has gone down, can we tell with the same enthusiasm or energy in the voice? Because just like the white cat and the black cat, both are gifts of the Lord.
Absolutely. You know, we spoke about Isaac Thagrid. There's that beautiful incident which he narrates. He says he goes through a lot of difficulties in life, you know. Personally, his brother dies in his arms and so many very, very harrowing experiences he has. He has a broken family and he never has had a happy childhood. And when one of those days when Swami calls him for an interview, he asks Swami that, Swami, why did I go through this difficult time? Because that has been something which is nagging him all his life. Why did I go through this bad experience? And why was I cursed the way I was? These are the words he uses. And when he asks Swami, why did I go through this? Swami says, to soften your heart. Okay, and he says in that moment, the way he looked at all his life changed. He says, my God, all the while what I saw as curse, today I know it's a boon. Today I know it's a blessing.
This, what you said, Prem, is so deeply embedded in everything that Swami says and does. I remember, you know, a beautiful poem that Swami has written, which says, which answers two questions. One question Swami is answering is, how will you know that I am near you?
Right.
And the second question that he is answering is, how will you know that you are near me? And if we see the answers for these two questions, they literally represent the white cat and the black cat. For example, let me read out the first part of the poem.
Okay.
It says, dear loved one, you ask, how will you know that I am near you? When on a sultry night everything is hot and still, the first cool breeze brushes your cheek. I'm caressing you, think of me. When the pangs of hunger are satisfied and loneliness is pierced by happiness, think of me. When your mouth is parched and you can hardly speak, the first sip of cool water, I am soothing you, think of me. When the cloud of death disappears first on the opening of the baby's smiling eyes, think of me. When I sprinkle your face with rain and wash the earth, the dry brown leaves, the first smell of clean rain, I am cleansing you, think of me. When pain dissolves and fear disappears, think of me. When steadfast eyes are horrified by the cruelties of life, the first glance of the silent setting sun, I am comforting you, think of me. All these imagery, you know, all this imagery brings forth a thing where you are in a deep trouble, you are in pain, and something soothing happens.
God brings solace.
God brings solace. And when God brings solace, those are the times we know that He is near us.
Then the second part, that is a very, very profound part of the poem where he says that, then you ask, how will you know when you are near me? And Swami goes on to answer, when the burning sun has scorched you and the earth, the sand and dust fill your eyes. Not a silver of shade about and you love me. When loneliness is accompanied by hunger and not one can be satisfied and you love me. When your lips are cracked, your tongue feels like clay, your throat seals up. There is no water about, not even a mirage in sight, and you love me. When you hold a dying child with eyes pleading, and you love me. When you stir the ocean, when I stir the ocean to a crescent, you flounder in its depth like a leaf, and you love me. When I take from you your most cherished possessions, on the first loss of your sight, darkness envelops you, and you love me. For everything you see, hear, smell, taste or touch belongs to me. So how can you give me what I already am but your love? And that I gave to you before time began as your sole possession. When you return it to me, then will I know you are truly mine, and I will dissolve your sorrow and happiness into me. That being me, I will place you in bliss forever, for I love and think of you constantly.
From your most loving father. That was what Swami had written.
Swami had written to a devotee many, many years ago.
So, well, Prem, the clock in our studios is showing 1:59. We can go on and speak so many things that crop up. But one thing that surely has come out of this discussion is that nothing is everything and everything is nothing. And that is what is the concept of the three zeros, where it is not as if God snatches away our wealth, God snatches away our relationships, or God snatches away our self-respect. It is a point, it is a time when God enters us in such a manner, He enters our lives in such a manner where all these three become meaningless or become zeros, which gain their value only if God is there. Yes, wealth is a fantastic thing, but when it is there with God. Because wealth is a zero and God is the one that gives value. Same way, relationships are magnificent when they are based on God. In the same manner, your self-respect, your self-esteem, what people think of you is wonderful, is a great thing. Your reputation, name and fame are wonderful, wondrous, as long as they are based on God. I think with that, we offer our most humble and grateful pranams at the lotus feet of our most beloved master, mother, father, friend, everything. And thank him for giving us this chance of being part of this beautiful satsang.
And Arvind, I'd like to close with a prayer which one student made to Swami in a similar situation when Swami had given him an instruction to do something which he didn't want to do. And eventually Swami prevailed and Swami made him do that. At the end of that, this student made this prayer to Swami. I think all of us collectively can make this prayer to Swami. He said, Swami, next time don't ask me to do anything. Just make me do it. Let me not have a choice or a will of my own. I think, Swami, don't give us the choice between you and anything else. Let there be no choices. Let you be the one who chooses what is right for us. And
I think that is a beautiful culmination, Prem. It started off with loving God. It started off with loving God in isolation, then to loving God in isolation, then choosing God over everything else, and finally the culmination is where God chooses, and we don't want that choice also, because we want only Swami.
Thank you, Swami, for this opportunity you've given both of us to be a part of this satsang, and we thank you on behalf of all our listeners who have also been able to be a part of this.
We will conclude with one beautiful song. You know, it speaks about the world as a chakki. What do you call a chakki? A grindstone, a millstone. Where one stone is joy and one stone is sorrow, and says that the person, Kabir, this is a composition of Saint Kabir, who says that between the millstones of joy and sorrow, every one of us get crushed. It is not as if sorrow is a bad thing and joy is a good thing. Both are millstones and both are equally responsible for us getting crushed. The only way you can save yourself is to move to the center of the millstone where that rod goes in, you know, the turning rod. And those grains do not get crushed. And that turning rod, Kabir says, is the Lord, the name of the Lord. Take refuge there, and then alone will you be saved. That beautiful song, which speaks about the ephemeral nature of the world.
चली का खेला कोई चला गया कोई जावे कोई गठरी बांध सिधावे कोई चला गया कोई जावे कोई गठरी बांध सिधावे कोई चली का खेला दो दिन का जग में मेला सब चला चली का खेला मात पिता सुत नारी भाई अंत सहायक नाही मात पिता सुत नारी भाई अंत सहायक नाही फिर क्यों भरता पाप का ठेला रे फिर क्यों भरता पाप का ठेला चला चली का खेला रे खेला रे खेला रे दो दिन का जग में मेला सब चला चली का खेला दो दिन का जग में मेला सब चला चली का खेला।